I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
It's a weekend edition of Parallax Views. And if you're wondering why we're having the upbeat music this time around, it's because, by popular demand, we're taking a little break from the dark side that is politics, the Jeffrey Epstein saga, and related subject matter, for something a little on the lighter side. It's a conversation with showbiz legend and the godfather of reality TV, John Barbour, about his new autobiography, the funny, warm, and comprehensive Your Mother's Not a Virgin, the bumpy life and times of the Canadian dropout who changed the face of American TV. If you're not familiar with John, as I said, he is the godfather of reality television, having helped bring to life the groundbreaking show Real People in 1979. He also worked with Frank Sinatra, interviewed such celebrities as boxer Muhammad Ali, gangster Mickey Cohen, Ronald Reagan, Jane Fonda, and American labor leader Cesar Chavez, among others. Oh, and he was also a player in the 1960s sick humor comedy scene amongst stand-up legends like Red Fox, Dick Gregory, and Lenny Bruce. He is, to put it country simple, a one-of-a-kind character. And he's got some strong opinions as well, having been a former movie critic, on issues ranging from politics to the newest Quentin Tarantino movie, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. You may not always agree with John, but you'll never be bored by him. And now, without further ado, my conversation with showbiz legend, the godfather of reality TV, John Barbour. Author, again, of Your Mother's Not a Virgin, the bumpy life and times of the Canadian dropout who changed the face of American TV. Available now from Trine Day. Welcome back to Parallax Views, the godfather of reality television, John Barbour.
Oh, are you saying welcome back to me? JG, thank you so much. It's a delight to be back. And I love the fact that your show is called Parallax, because when I first started as a mailboy at Paramount Studios, the first time I came to the country illegally before I was deported the first time, I was a mail boy, and one of the guys that I delivered the mail to was Alan Pakula. And Alan Pakula was just like in his young 20s. He didn't have any secretary. He took all the mail himself, and we used to chat a bit because I was almost the same age as he was. I was a mail boy, and he was an aspiring producer. And, of course, he went on to be one of the very best, most tasteful producers in Hollywood, To Kill a Mockingbird, and just All the President's Men. He died an accidental, horrible death. But when I became a very successful critic, he called me to come to his office, and I went down to his office, and he handed me a script, and he said, I'd like you to play the senator in this script. And I looked at it, and it was a Parallax View, and it was going to star Warren Beatty. And I told him I had to turn him down, and the reason I had to turn him down, I was a film critic at both Los Angeles Magazine and KNBC in Los Angeles on the 6 o'clock news with Tom Snyder. And I felt it was a conflict of interest. Can you see how much America has changed in all that time? Because now in America, there's no such thing as a conflict of interest. But I felt it deeply at the time. I turned a lot of movie roles down, even though at one point in my career, I was a pretty successful actor. So there you go. So I'm glad you call it Parallax. And the last time that you and I chatted, I think might have been in May, and you reminded me that we talked about Harlan Ellison, and I'd be glad to tell you a story about Harlan that I don't think I ever told you the first time. But Harlan passed away a year ago. The very last show he did before he died, he had a stroke, was my show. And he wanted me to finish writing my book, Your Mother's Not a Virgin, The Bumpy Life and Times of the Canadian Dropout Who Changed the Face of American Television. He wanted me to finish it so we could write the foreword. Sadly, I never did. He never got to do it. But indeed, I got a really excellent writer, Donald Jeffries, to write the foreword to the book. So again, thank you so much for having me back. I really love talking to you.
Well, I'm really glad to have you back on. I've really enjoyed your autobiography, Your Mother's Not a Virgin. It's funny because it's a really warm telling of a period in American history and in Hollywood specifically that people are getting more interested in now. But, you know, I think that it's much more sentimental and warm than something like, you know, that new Tarantino movie, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, that everyone's talking about now.
Well, what are they saying about it? Because I have a few things that I want to say about it. As a matter of fact, the reason I went to see it, of course, is I was in Los Angeles a month ago to meet my Canadian publicist. I'm going to Canada starting in September in Vancouver. I'm going to return to Toronto as a prodigal son to try to make the book a bestseller up there. But anyway, I had dinner with my Canadian publicist and my son. My son just signed a deal with Netflix to co-produce and co-write a 10-part science fiction series, and he just spent 2 or 3 years as the co-executive producer and one of the writers on Criminal Minds. And we were celebrating at Musa Frank's. And at one point, I've been going to Musa Frank's restaurant in Hollywood for about 50 years.
It's legendary in Hollywood.
Yes, it's 100 years old. And sadly, on the menu, they used to put a little history of the restaurant and the people who used to come there to eat. I mean, that story was often better than the food, even though the food is excellent. But one time, only two people ever had a credit card to Musso's, and that was Steven Spielberg and myself. So anyway, I decided, because I had heard that there was a scene. I quit being a film critic, of course, in 1979 when I accidentally got Real People on the air, or I got one of four specials on the air on NBC, and I couldn't do it any longer. And I just I didn't want to go to the movies anymore, but because there were supposedly scenes about Musil Franks, I decided that I would go to see the film. And I did. So I'm going to, can I tell you a little story about this?
Definitely, definitely.
Okay. This, I'm paraphrasing my review. I went Friday night. I spent 5 years as the film critic for NBC, as I mentioned, and I was 10 years at Los Angeles Magazine, and I decided to quit, as I said, because I accidentally got a Real People special on NBC. And within 5 minutes of announcing that I was retiring as the film critic, I got a call from Neil Simon. And Neil Simon and I had become friends because I hammered one of his films. The film that he did about the two comedians. You remember the name of the film? The Goal? You remember the name?
I'm blanking on it right now, actually.
It starred Walter Matthau and George Burns. And it was about two New York comedians, Jewish comedians, who were successful, and they grew to hate one another. They parted for 30 years, and they came back once again. The Sunshine Boys.
The Sunshine Boys.
Okay, yeah. Was the name of the film. It was Walter Matthau's worst acting ever, and George Burns' least pleasant appearance in a film. When I reviewed that movie, I said that Neil Simon, even if Shakespeare got residuals, the wealthiest playwright in history is Neil Simon. He has no need of 20th Century Fox or MGM or Columbia or Universal to finance a film. He could pay for his own if he loved them. And I said he wrote this great comedy about two Jewish comedians in New York. The stars of it were two Jewish actors, Jack Albertson and Sam Levine, both of whom you might remember. Brilliant actors, but both Jewish. The parts were so well written, J.G., that anybody who was not Jewish could identify with them because they were so human. And I said that in the review. So I said, Neil Simon comes to Hollywood, and not trusting his own writing, he tries to Presbyterianize these Jews so middle America would love him. And it turned in to be the worst film that he's ever made. There's nobody like him in the film except Benjamin, because Benjamin is the nephew, likes both of these men. And so at least there's somebody who's semi-sympathetic. And I said, the next thing that Neil Simon needs to write is a letter firing himself as his own casting director. I was walking in my office when the phone was ringing, and it was Neil, and he was howling with laughter. He said, oh, my God, you are so right, and I'm so sorry. And I didn't know what to say, because really he is the king of comedy writers. So we chatted for a long time. He said he was getting the Heart of Israel Award at the Beverly Hills Hilton Hotel, and would I come down and emcee it? And I did. And as a result, we became friends, and he did the liner notes, or some of the liner notes, on my album based on my reviews called I Met a Man I Didn't Like. And he called me about 3 months later. He said, John, that's the least successful writing I've ever done. Anyway, when I announced, J.G., that I wasn't going to be a critic anymore, he called and he said, you can't do that. Who's going to tell the emperors of Hollywood who make movies that we have no clothes except you? And I said, Neil, frankly, I've run out of imaginative ways to say it's a piece of crap. Now, I have seen thousands of movies, a couple of movies I absolutely saved from oblivion. And one of them was Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, because it was being dumped by Warner Brothers. But in any event, one movie I did love, and I must tell you honestly, even though it's brutal, but it was brilliant, Shakespeare's brutal, was Pulp Fiction. Mm-hmm. It had a great plot. It had an absolutely fabulous cast. And more than that, it had great dialogue. J.G., there are only two guys left who make movies who can write good dialogue, and one is Tarantino, and one is Woody Allen. They don't write, it's comic books anymore, so that's one of the reasons I don't go. But in any event, none of that, none of Tarantino's talent is evident in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Well, I was going to say real quick, it seems like a movie that turns this brutal slaughter of Sharon Tate into like a fairy tale. It's kind of off-putting.
That's the point that I'm trying to get to. I mean, if the movie's set in February of 1969, so if you lived at that time or interested, you might like the references to the television shows or the actors or the places they visited. J.G., I was active in television at the time, and none of that interested me. Now, the main character, as you know, is played by DiCaprio, and he plays an ordinary actor you have no sympathy for, none whatsoever. The only thing interesting about him, he lives next door to Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski. And that's where you know the slaughter of Sharon Tate is going to take place. Now, have you seen the film?
I have not had a chance to see it yet, but I've heard a lot of mixed reviews.
Okay, then I'm going to tell you this. Brad Pitt is excellent. He's the only excellent thing in the film because he plays the sidekick who doesn't care that he's nobody in Hollywood. He's just a stuntman and he's just getting by. There is one totally brilliant scene in the movie, made more brilliant by the presence of Brad Pitt, and that's when Brad Pitt picks up one of Charlie Manson's underage girls hitchhiking in Westwood, and she wants to go to the Spawn Ranch. And that's where the Manson family lives. So he drives her to the Spawn Ranch. He meets a bunch of other hippie girls like her. But more important, he meets Tex Watson. Tex Watson is the man who actually butchered Sharon Tate, cut her open 44 times while she was alive and pregnant. Really horrifying, okay? The only thing that now, had the whole movie been as interesting and electric as that scene, it could have been a masterpiece. Instead, it's a masterpiece of crap, because the only thing that keeps you glued to the screen, JG, is knowing that that slaughter is going to come. And you wonder how Tarantino is going to handle it. But guess what? He doesn't. Once Upon a Time is how they start fairy tales. And what Tarantino tried to do is he called it Once Upon a Time because he wanted to treat, as you said, the slaughter as a fairy tale. Now, I'm not going to tell you how the movie ends. It took all my strength not to yell at the end of the movie, because watching it, I got the distinct impression if Tarantino had the opportunity, he would be telling us that the guys that are waiting with loaded rifles in Dealey Plaza to blow Kennedy's head off do have their own heads blown off prior to the time that the limousine with Jackie and John come by and they drive off and live happily ever after. I have seen, from the time I was six and almost an orphan kid, thousands of movies. 99% of them I all liked. This is the only movie I have seen in my entire life that brought me out of retirement to tell people, and it's seen by thousands, the review. It is the only film where I absolutely loathed and hated the ending for two reasons. The first reason being, it denies telling us the truth, JG, of how horrifying and sadistic and inhuman one human being can treat other human beings. And I say this because after years and years and years of the government lying to me about fake wars and lying to me about the murders of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King and John F. Kennedy and Malcolm X, and after years of lies from the mainstream media not informing us and misinforming us, Now we come a guy, a filmmaker, who once upon a time could make a really good movie. This is not one of them, so save your money, but most of all, save your disappointment. Now that was my review, which you can see on YouTube. Interesting thing is, I had at least a dozen and a half people yesterday who read my review, and they were forewarned, but out of curiosity and a lot of out of affection for Tarantino's other films that they liked, they went to see it. JG, they hated it more than I did. They were angry that I wasn't angrier and telling them that the slaughter never took place. You know, my wife said to me, I don't want to go see that film because I don't think I could stand the slaughter. And I said, I don't think they would show it. They would probably show you newscasts of what happened in the Tate household. That would be the smart way to handle it. But he didn't handle it at all. And I'm outraged. I will never, ever see another Tarantino film. The same thing is with, I hate to say this, with Robert De Niro. At the Tony Awards last year, when he used the foulest, most vulgar language to tell a president of the United States, one I don't even care for, to go F himself. I mean, that's so reprehensible, because now De Niro has destroyed for me all the great movies he ever done, because I cannot any longer enjoy him in The Godfather or Taxi Driver or anything else, because all I see him is being a jerk on stage, saying something that he ad-libbed because he didn't have a writer who could write something for him. I didn't mean to digress there, by the way. Oh, I just do want to tell you one last thing about the review of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I got a note from a 33-year-old PhD student in Belgrade, going to the university, getting a master's in philosophy. She took the review and translated it into French and sent it to every French critic, because every French critic treats Tarantino like the dramatic he is to drama, what Jerry Lewis is to comedy. They loved the movie. And she sent him a review and said, this is a real review. You better go back and revisit the film. As a result of the review, she went to Amazon and said, if you write a book as good as that review, I'm going to buy three copies of your book. And she bought three copies of the book at Amazon. And she lives in Belgrade, Serbia.
Huh. That's a great story. The thing I like about your approach, not just to film criticism, but also with your new autobiography, Your Mother's Not a Virgin, which is available, of course, from Trindade Publications. The thing I love about it is you have this warmth and this need to tell the truth. You like people. You're a populist in the most positive sense of that word. And I wanted to talk about, how when you came to Hollywood, it was during a very turbulent time. You know, you had civil rights, you had the Hollywood blacklist, and all of these anti-communist propagandists and whatnot. And you sort of stood up against that and had friends and people around you that would also speak up against that, like Haskell Wexler, one of the most important cinematographers in film history.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to tell you, JG, everything wonderful that ever happened to me, getting real people on the air, becoming the Boswell to tell Jim Garrison's stories in two of the definitive documentaries on the murder of John Kennedy and the birth and purpose of fake news, and then to become the private writer to the world's most powerful entertainer, Frank Sinatra, for 4.5 years, they all happened by accident. But all the other things were totally, totally well planned. I did not speak up against anything. I was only 17 years old, for crying out loud. I didn't know anything, but it all struck me as odd, because here I was living in a country that I fell in love with, because I went to see all these Frank Capra movies in Toronto as a kid. You know, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington with Jimmy Stewart. Do you remember the film?
Yes, it's a classic.
It's a classic, but look, Jimmy's, people aren't aware of this, but I was and am, just as a kid. Jimmy Stewart never won. If Claude Rains hadn't gone berserk and came back out in front of Congress and started yelling that he was a fraud, fraud in Congress would have continued as it does to this day. But I knew that, you know, but I came to the United States because of, they had a First Amendment and I fell in love with movie sets. But when I got here, it was at the darkest times. It was at one of the times that I was totally aware that America's First Amendment was shut down by the House Un-American Activities Committee. And it was shut down harder in Hollywood. But I didn't pay any attention to that. Now, if we have time, I'll get to the story about this accountant that I met in the rooming house who wore a pin in his lapel that said, better red than dead. And I said, you know, if we were in Canada, I would have a rose there. I wouldn't. Why would you have a stupid sign like that? Why would you want to be dead? He said, because I don't want to be red. And I would say to him, hold it, you can be any color you want if you're alive, but you're nothing but ashes and gray when you're dead. I mean, that's so we used to get into these weird arguments. He loathed. He's just a young guy. And he called himself a young Republican. Now, I don't know anything, J.G. And I started to laugh, and I said, that's hilarious. And he said, what's so hilarious about it? And that I said, that's the first time I've ever heard young and Republican in the same sentence, you know, because they're all so old. But he hated FDR. He thought God made him crippled because he was a commie and gave him an ugly life, a wife like Eleanor to look at in the morning to make him suffer even more. Now, that's how loathsome he was in his hatred for FDR. And I said to him, you know, your grandfather is collecting Social Security. You should thank FDR every day. He introduced it to save capital. Now, I didn't know anything. I'm just repeating stuff that I have heard, but I literally know absolutely nothing. But he's the one that called the FBI on me, and that's why I was arrested and deported the first time, which I'll get to. But let's get to Haskell Wexler, because this will give you a lot of insight into what the country was like at the time. And at the time that John Kennedy was killed, a company could only own 5 television stations or 5 radio stations. Today, because Bill Clinton, the worst president in American history, signed the Communications Act in 1996, it turned 95% of all our media over to 6 monopolistic corporations who do business with the government.
He basically turned the Democratic Party more and more right wing.
Well, it's horrifying because he signed NAFTA. And we were warned. Who was the Texan who just died who ran against him and Bush? You know who I'm talking about? The billionaire Texan ran against Clinton and Bush. He just died a week ago. Oh, my God. I can't
believe I'm blanking on his name.
Well, that's 2 of those you blanked on. I blanked on it, too. But it'll come to me.
Ross Perot.
Ross Perot used to buy his own time. And he was on stage with George Bush and Bill Clinton. And he pointed at both of them. He said, if you elect either one of these president, we will be going broke because they're going to sign NAFTA and send our jobs overseas. And indeed, that's what happened. Clinton did that. Clinton also repealed Glass-Steagall. Glass-Steagall was passed into law in the 30s by Roosevelt during the New Deal to save capitalism from socialism. And what it is, it was depriving Wall Street of the ability to gamble with money that wasn't theirs. That was repealed by Clinton. And in 2008, I lost a $900,000 home, along with millions of other people, because of that. And nobody went to jail or prison. But to get back to Haskell Wexler. It was in the middle 50s. I was in the country illegally, but working as a mailboy at Paramount, which I absolutely loved. I mean, getting closer and closer to show business. And there was a fellow there His name was Angelo. Angelo was in his early 30s, and he was in charge of the 8x10 publicity department and all the photographs that would go out of all the stars. He was the son of a very successful baker in Chicago, the most successful baker in Chicago. I won't tell you the last name, but his first name was Angelo, and the father wanted him to take over the bakery business. But he wanted to make movies. He didn't want to make buns. So he ran away to Hollywood, got a job at Paramount, and he wanted to be the next Spiros Skouras, who was a Greek, who was the head of 20th Century Fox. And he and I became friends. He was an absolute nervous wreck. He was prematurely gray because of his father hounding him every week to come back and take over the business. And there was another Greek by the name of Andy Finity, who sold a movie to Paramount, and he hired a young director who became successful by the name of Irving Kirshner to direct it. Anyway, Angela asked me one day, because I'm in the mailroom and I'm also in acting classes, so I think I want to be an actor. He said, could you write a script? And if you wrote a script, what would you do? And I said, well, first of all, I can't write a script. But if you're going to write a script, he said, listen, I have $6,000 or $8,000. We could make a little movie, but how would you do it? And he said, because Andy Finity, a young Greek, just sold this script to Paramount, and I think you could do one better. I said, hold it. I'm not a writer. And he said, what would you do? I said, well, you'd have to write it as a Western outdoors, so there are no sets to build, and you have to shoot it in one day from sunup to sundown. That's it. And I don't know what. So he said, I'll give you $1,000 if you write one. I said, I don't know how to write. I don't want your money. Keep your money. He said, would you try something? So what I did is I sat down, and in a couple of weeks, I hacked. It was a hack job, you know, like Treasure of Sierra Madre, but only ripoffs of stuff like that. And it was called The Sunsets in Hell, about a four guys who rob a bank in the morning, and they shoot someone. One of them gets shot. They race off with what they think they've lost the money, and a posse is after them. And the whole movie is about them falling apart and the posse chasing them. And it has a trick ending, which he loves. So anyway, he calls me 2 weeks later, and he has an appointment with a guy named Lindsay Partsons, who makes all of Republic's westerns. And the guy just loved the script. Somehow the script got to him through Andy Finity. So they say, will you come out and have a meeting with Lindsay Parsons? So we go out to meet with Lindsay Parsons, and there are two people there. One is Barry Sullivan, the actor, who said he wanted to be a director, and he so loved my script, this was going to be his first assignment. And the other was a cinematographer named Haskell Wexler. Now, we have to tell the audience who Haskell is. At the time, he had only made one movie, Stakeout on Dope Street. Shot in New York City so his brother Yale could become an actor. Haskell Wexler became one of the best cinematographers in history. He won his first Academy Award, I believe, for Bound for Glory, and then he won his second, I believe, with Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. For, you remember that film?
Yeah. I was going to mention, too, he also directed one of Quentin Tarantino's favorite movies, Medium Cool with Robert Forster, and that was filmed during the Chicago riots at the DNC convention.
That's exactly right. It's a classic. It's called Medium Cool. He did do that. So in any event, he hadn't done it at the time, but he'd only done this one small movie in New York at the time. And so they were going to make this movie. So I couldn't believe it. Here, I'm a mail boy this 1 minute, and then in a couple of weeks, I'm going to end up getting somewhere around $50,000. It's installments of three. But 10 days later, Lindsay Parsons calls Angelo and tells him Republic does not want to make any more Westerns. Could I turn it into a crime drama, you know, like what Asphalt Jungle became? I said, no, I'm done with it. And, of course, Angelo was so discouraged he was done with Hollywood. He was so desperate to become successful in Hollywood, he even angered his father by marrying a Jewish girl. But she divorced him after the failure of the movie, and then he went back to Hollywood. So I'm back in the mailroom. And about a month and a half later, I get a call from Haskell out of the blue. And he said, could you come up to my house? And I said, yeah, sure. So I go up to his house, and it's his Mediterranean mansion on Mulholland Drive, just above the Hollywood Bowl. I mean, it's just beautiful. All white stucco with an acre of gardens looking down over Hollywood Boulevard. Just stunning, stunning, stunning. His wife's name is Marion, beautiful woman who never wore makeup. He had a young boy named Mark, who's now about 50 years of age. And he had a very productive German shepherd named Blackie. And he had two books with him. And he said, I'll tell you why I'm here. Have you ever heard of Albert Maltz? And I said, no. I said, the only Maltz I've ever heard of are strawberry and chocolate. And he chuckled. He said, have you ever heard of the Blacklist? I said, well, I hear about it in the news, but I don't understand it. He said, yes, that's the people are being blacklisted in Hollywood by the House and American Activities Committee. And Maltz is one of the 10 who refused to testify. And I said, hold it. Doesn't America have a First Amendment in the Constitution? Well, he howled that I would be so naive. And so I said, well, why is everybody being so quiet? And he said, well, they're afraid for their jobs. I have a book here called A Long Day and a Short Life by Albert Maltz. And it reminded me of your script because it all happens in one day. He is sentenced to jail here in Los Angeles. And it's about a day in jail. And you'd be the perfect one to write it. And I'll pay you $600 a week for 6 weeks if you write it. And I said, well, why are you doing it if it's blacklisted? He said, have you read this book? And he showed me a book by William Bradford Huey called The Execution of Private Slovak. Isn't it astonishing, J.G., that I remembered this from 40-some-odd years ago? I mean, just have you heard of that book, The Execution of Private Slovak?
You know, I'm familiar with the author of it. He was very well-liked by a lot of civil rights advocates, including Martin Luther King.
Absolutely. He's a brilliant writer. He's a brilliant crime writer. Well, he wrote a book about the execution of Private Slovak. Eisenhower sentenced him to death as the only deserter in the U.S. Army during the Second World War. That's the story. Really powerful stuff. Anyway, Haskell says to me, Frank Sinatra has bought the book, and he's at Columbia, and he's going to make the film. That means, and he's going to hire Albert Maltz to write the screenplay. That means he's going to bring Maltz off of the blacklist. And I have just bought Maltz's book. And so I'm going to be privy to a news-making book, and you and I are going to make a movie. So what happens? He gives it to me. 6 weeks later, I deliver him the script, and he's shooting a movie now at MGM. He keeps calling me during the day. Oh, God, John, this is wonderful. This is wonderful. Then he calls me to say he's finished reading the script, and they're going to have a reading up at his house, and at the reading will be Richard Widmark. Now, to me, Richard Widmark was my first favorite villain in movies. Do you remember Kiss of Death?
Yes.
He played Tommy Udo, who throws this little old lady in a wheelchair down the stairs and cackles. Now, I'm a kid, but I just loved it. It was so brutal.
It's a great gangster movie.
It's what Ben Hecht wrote it. The only man to whom ever I wrote a fan letter. If you wish to know about that, I'll tell you that later. And it starred Victor Mature and was a great, great gangster movie. So in any event, I'm going to meet Richard Widmark and a couple of other famous actors who are coming to Haskell's house to have a reading of my script of A Long Day and a Short Life. And I show up and no one is there except Marion and Mark and the dog. And Haskell's really depressed. And I said, what happened? He said, Peter Lawford called Sinatra, and Joe Kennedy, the father of John, called Sinatra. And they said that John was going to be running for the presidency very soon, and it wasn't a good idea that one of his best friends, Frank Sinatra, was dealing with communists in Hollywood. So he canceled the project. So I said to Haskell, I said, Haskell, hold it. You don't have to have Albert Maltz's name on the screenplay. It can just be not my name. You don't even have to say it's from his book. I said, we could shoot it easily in black and white in Chicago. Now, Haskell was the mega millionaire son of the founder of Allied Radio. His brother Yale, he had two brothers, and brother Yale was a struggling actor who spent more time in his yacht screwing starlets than he did in movies. Very handsome kid, so you can understand that. But Yale was a very, Haskell was a very, very dedicated filmmaker and extremely liberal. I mean, also almost to the point of being a communist or a socialist, but very outspoken and very liberal. He says, no, we can't do it. I said, but you could fund it yourself. I mean, you know, you have all that money and you probably get Chicago to chip in money for you, shoot it in black and white. And he said, no, no, it was over with. But he assured me that sometime in the future, we would do something else together. Now, here's how the story continues. Haskell was going to go to a place called Recife in Brazil to shoot stories about poor, overworked, exploited peasants in Brazil, in South America. He asked me if I would house sit for him, and he would pay me. I said, no, I don't want any money. I'll take money for writing. I'm not taking money for house sitting. So he left the dog. The son went to somebody else, and he and Marion went to South America. He had the greatest library in his house that I'd ever seen. It looked like the West. It looked like the Western version of the Moscow Library. And for 12 and 14 days that I was there, I never read that. I left the house. I read about a book a day. I started with Das Kapital, Karl Marx, Dialectical Materialism, and reading all about the slaughter of laborers in America by American corporations that hired gunmen to shoot striking women and striking children. I mean, it was an unbelievable read, all about the brutal history of American capitalism. And it was mind-blowing for me as a kid because I knew nothing. So anyway, he came back. But thinking about the relationship he had with his father, and I had no father, I decided before I was going to do anything else, now I'm in my early 20s, I'm going to go to England and track down my father, and I find him. He owns a very successful advertising agency in Scotland, Glasgow and Soakie Hall Street, called Angus Barbara McLaren Productions Publicity. And I think I'm going to read The Rich Man's Life, but I decide that I don't want to be with him anymore because he had deserted our family and left, and I came back to the United States. But I wrote to Haskell about the meeting, and Haskell was really moved by it. So then I snuck back into the United States a second time. If you want to talk about the first deportation as a result of this accountant, which I mentioned earlier, I'll get to it. So I go back. Anyway, there was one point in my life where one of my mother's uncles tries to literally murder me when I'm 12 years of age by using a real bow and arrow and me as target practice. And it's a great but horrifying story in the book, which you have. In any event, what happens is I am sent away to a farm in northern Ontario so that my mother can spend more time with this guy and other uncles. And at one point, myself and a couple of other kids get lost for 2 days in a forest. And they send the entire military and the helicopters and everything looking for us. Okay. And we are eventually found only about 20 yards from the road. But we couldn't see it because of the dense foliage. And we were lucky we weren't killed by bears, even though one tried to attack us. So in any event, Haskell is so moved by my childhood story. He says, I'll give you $600 a week and my office at Channel 11, Metro Media Studios, to write the screenplay about your childhood. And I thought, you know, what a wonderful thing to do is to be able to take all this horror and recycle it into something meaningful and something positive, and had an extremely positive ending. And so I go ahead and I write it. And it's called Endless Summer. And he keeps calling me from the studio, telling me how much he enjoys the read. I finish the script and I give it to him. And he calls me back and he says, up until the ending, this is one of the greatest things I ever read. And I said, well, what's wrong with the ending? And he says, it's too Disney-like. It's too upbeat. And I said, what do you mean? It's too upbeat. I said, listen, it ends with me getting on a train and coming to the United States as a kid. You can't get more upbeat than that. It has to have a positive ending. He said, no, that part of it is it. And I said to him, I said, Haskell, listen, that's such an insult to say it reminds you of Disney, for crying out loud, because Disney never, ever dealt with wife beating or the possible incest or the murder of a child or any of that, or drunken parents. So what are you talking about? He said, well, somehow the ending needs to be darker. Now I'm furious. And I say to him, you know how you can make it darker? I know how we can make it darker right now. And he said, how? I said, make him a black kid. And he hung up on me and never spoke to me again. A lot of limousine liberals in Hollywood were exactly like Haskell. They could never always put their feet where their mouth was. And I admire Haskell a lot, because when I was arrested and deported the second time, I had to get a lot of character references. And mercifully, he gave me a wonderful character reference. But that was the story of my relationship with Haskell. And that's what America was like in those days. But you know something, J.G.? I didn't understand much of that. You have no idea what I learned reading Haskell's Library. You know, obviously, the intellectual founder of the American Revolution is Thomas Paine, right? Common sense. I have spoken to scores of universities, and asking at the end of the sessions, doing question and answer, I ask all of these, majoring in history and sociology and politics, where is Thomas Paine buried? I have not found one American who knows what happened to Thomas Paine's body. That's how underinformed Americans are. We have been an anti-intellectual from the beginning of the foundation of this country, and we become more and more anti-intellectual as each year and each day goes by. We used to have a thing in television called the Fairness Doctrine. When I had Ronald Reagan on my show in 1970, I had to have a Democrat on, and then I had to have a socialist on. You could not have had a Hannity or a Rush Limbaugh or a Rachel Maddow or any of those people in those days, because you would have had to give people time to the opposition. That was all destroyed by Bill Clinton. Now, I was called, as a creator of real people, by the best critic in America. His name was Gary Deeb. He wrote for the Chicago Tribune, syndicated. He's the guy that said television is the only business in America where competition does not improve the product. And he knew when I was in Chicago filling in on a morning show before they hired Charlie Rose and then Oprah Winfrey, which is all in the book, he knew that I wanted to do a show about real people on television, that they were much more interesting than actors who had to have stuff written for them. Anyway, when I got it on the air, he dubbed me the godfather of reality television. For that, I will take enormous vows. We were responsible for playing a major role in getting that Vietnam Memorial Wall built in Washington, D.C. I got a presidential citation for the Navajo Code Talkers. And for John Walsh, I helped get the Missing Children's Act passed, which he could not do. And that's because of stories I did on real people. So I'll take vows for that. I will not take vows for anything that's been called reality television since. Because as you know, when I started in television, you had to have a modicum of talent, you had to have a modicum of personality, and you had to be relatively smart. those would be handicaps to getting a job in American television today. All you need to be a star in American reality TV is an absence of shame.
Why, I wanted to cut in real quick if I could.
Sure.
Why, I was going to say, I think what sets real people apart from today's reality shows like the Kardashians and the Hiltons is that you dealt with real people, as the title would suggest. And I know there's one point in the book where you're covering some of these stories, that you're pitching the stories for real people. And, you know, I think someone says, oh, these people seem kind of weird. And you're like, well, that's the point, but we're not going to make fun of them. We're just going to talk about them. We're going to tell their story. There's a lot of warmth to that show. You treat these people like human beings, and they're the everyday man and woman.
You touched on it perfectly, because the argument that I had the first 2 years of the show, I ran it. And that's why it became number one. And before I got it on the air, I told Maury Gelman at Daily Variety that I was going to change the face of American television with what I called the entertainment of reality. The moment we got the first special, I knew that would happen. So did my wife, so I can tell you a couple of stories about that, how we happened to cast the thing. And George Slaughter always wanted to attack these people to show how idiotic they were. And I said, no, you want to exploit them. George, we're going to explain them. We're going to let these people explain their own lifestyles. For example, you had one of the stories was a stripper for God. Now, that's funny to laugh at the title of that, but this is a girl, a brunette in New York City, stunning brunette, 6 feet tall, gorgeous body. And she said, God gave me this body, and it's a body for men to look at. So I'm going to become a stripper, and 10% of what I get, I'm going to tie to my church. And that's what she did. So she was able to explain her own lifestyle. We did a story about the only professional vampire hunter listed in the Yellow Pages in America, in New York. And it's a hilarious story, but he tells his own story. And it's up to the viewer to decide whether or not this is funny or not. I was the one who just crafted the stories. We would shoot 2 hours of tape on them, and I would boil it down to 6 or 8 minutes of a story.
And it was also people from all walks of life, every race, gender. It was very inclusive.
Absolutely. It had every... We even did the story. We did the first transsexuals. I did a story of a 6 foot man and a 5 foot girl who got married. They were in Arizona, and they decided right after the honeymoon that they were meant to be opposites. So the wife felt she should have been a man, and the male felt he should have been a woman. And they saved up enough money to have a transgender operation. And I must tell you, nobody in that city, when we went to that city, would talk to me about them. But we still did their story. We got to explain their story. And I'm telling you, it got like a 50 share. You never heard of anything getting such a high share. But nobody could look at this and laugh at these people. They had to be empathetic with them and smile at the dilemma that they were in. I mean, that's just... What that is that is storytelling. You know, people ask me, because I've done the two definitive films on Jim Garrison, how Garrison picked me over Oliver Stone to tell his story is because I was fired the first time I tried to put him on the air in 1970 on my first morning talk show, news talk show on ABC, where I won my first Emmy. As soon as I booked him, I was fired and he was canceled. And then when I was doing Real People, I had the number one show in the country. I figured now I can tell the story again. And George Slaughter and I got into a huge argument. He sabotaged the story I did on Garrison, making him look like a fool, and I lost Real People. So Garrison was well aware of the fact that I'd given up two enormous, the most successful shows in television at the time, to try to tell his story, because I am not a conspiracy theorist. I'm a storyteller. And his story, next to the Civil War in this country, is the greatest American story ever to be told. And it's a cold case now at the Justice Department. And the reason that Trump is not releasing the files, he says he's going to release the CIA files. The CIA files is trying to overrule him. They're telling him it's national security. Well, how can a 54-year-old murder be national security? Because you and I know they do not have files that say this is how we killed the son of a bitch, because everything's in code. What they don't want to release is the fact they have the Jim Garrison files. And he speaks in English, and he names names. He knows how much each shooter got paid, names everything. That's what they don't want released. That is what they don't want released. And if Donald Trump wants to make America great again, since he's the one that pointed out fake news, which is the reason I did the second documentary, because he reminded me of Garrison, all he has to do is reverse Bill Clinton's Communications Act. So if the Democrats don't get themselves together, it'll be a landslide victory for Trump in 2020. And hopefully at that time, he'll finally get ready to drain the swamp and the deep state by reversing the Communications Act and not letting anyone own more than 7 television stations in this country. When Kennedy was killed, there were 1,500 different owners. Now there are only 6.
Well, you know, maybe to back up a little, I think people, I don't want people to take the ending of the Eddie Haskell from Leave It to Beaver. I meant the Haskell Wexler story that you told and get the wrong impression because of your comment regarding race. I get the feeling that you don't have a racist bone in your body. In fact, what you were doing was...
Not at all. You know that my mentor when I started as a comic was Red Fox.
Well, that's what I was going to get to. A lot of your work actually ties into the civil rights movement and sort of making fun of how white people were viewing black people during that era.
Oh, that's so smart of you, because the first album I did was called It's Tough to Be White. And you want to know how I got the idea to do the album?
Well, first I want to say that was that was your first comedy album. You were
right.
You were really a part of the whole what people degrade it as sick humor, the Mort Saul sort of humor, Lenny Bruce. You were a part of that great important movement. Those people were telling the truth.
Yeah, and it's funny the way I started that is do you remember David Susskind?
I'm familiar with the name. Tell me a little bit more.
Oh my God! Yes, David Susskind had a great talk show host called Open End, but he was the most successful television producer of movies in history on television. David Susskind. Search him. I'm sure you will read. You're too young, but anyway, he had a great talk show. One day I'm watching this talk show, and he has two guests on. One is a Jew and one is a black. And they're both in their late 50s, and they both served time in a penitentiary for a murder they did not commit. The Jew had served 29 years, and the black had only served 19 years. And with them on the show was a very famous civil libertarian lawyer out of San Francisco, whose last name was Ehrlich. He was a renowned lawyer, but an even more renowned drunk. And he happened to be drunk when he was on the show. Anyway, David was a lot like Haskell, and that he was very left-leaning and liberal and sympathetic to minorities. So even though the Jew had served 29 years and the black 19 years, Susskind points at the black and then leans toward Ehrlich and says, how is it possible that this man in this country with a constitution could be sentenced to 19 years for a crime he did not commit? So Ehrlich hiccups. He says, David, look at him. Look at him. He's a black man. And you got to know that in America, when they arrest a black man, he doesn't stand a Chinaman's chance. Well, I howled. I screamed with laughter. And not one of them caught the fact of this faux pas by this guy. So I told Red the story. And he started to laugh. And then I said to him, you know, it's tough, getting tough to be white in this country. And he laughed again. And then I ad-libbed a whole bunch of lines, and he said, record it. And I said, well, hold it. I don't want people to think I'm bigoted. He said, shoot, man, make it first and then explain. He was brilliant. As a matter of fact, he once said of heroes, thinking of Jim Garrison, he said, heroes ain't born. They're cornered. And when I got my first entertainment show on television, the second person I booked on the show was Red Fox. The first person I booked was Harlan Ellison. And Red Fox's real name is John Sanford.
Sanford and Son.
Sanford and Son. And he called himself Fred because his older brother Fred had died, and he wanted to honor his brother. And he had been in jail as a kid or a younger man with Malcolm X. They were the best of friends. And, of course, when I did the album, Dick Gregory did the liner notes, the most famous black comedian in the world at the time. Couldn't wait to do the liner notes for me. And only two white people would ever play the album on the air. One was Bob Crane, who became the star later of Hogan's Heroes. And the other was Joe Pyne, a guy who was the first angry man on television.
He was sort of the predecessor to combat TV shows like Wally George, Downey Jr., Jerry Springer. Yeah.
How come you remember him and you don't remember David Susskind? Yeah, because Joe Pyne predated David Susskind. Can I tell you a Harlan Ellison story? And if I have told you, stop me. But I don't think I told you. Can I tell you?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Here's the story. When Merv Griffin left Westinghouse to go to CBS, he had recommended me as his replacement. So they signed me as his replacement. And I did so well because I did a stand-up that I got really nice ratings. But they used my ratings to try to get David Frost's money down. And the reason the head of Westinghouse, a guy named McGannon, and Chet Collier, their programming guy, wanted David Frost was because when they went to London, they could go to 10 Downing Street and Buckingham Palace. And I tried to talk them into getting four other guys like me and do Gone with the Wind, The Search for Scarlett O'Hara, The Search for the New Host of Merv's Show, and they turned me down. When they hired this guy who died, David, when he died eventually, there was a call from a guy named Chuck Young, who was a guy that gave Joe Pyne his first show. And he said, they're going to bomb with that Englishman. He said, will you come out here and do a show, a poor man's Tonight Show on Saturday night, so that when he bombs, we have you? I said, I'd love to. And so when I had filled in for Merv, there was a magazine in L.A. called The Free Press that had the best television column in the world. And it was called The Glass Teat. And it was authored by Harlan Ellison. Now, let me tell you quickly, and the audience, Harlan Ellison, along with Asimov and Ray Bradbury, was the best science fiction writer in the world. But he could do other things than that, but best Star Trek and stuff like that. He wrote a short story called The Terminator. It was stolen by Paramount and turned into that film with Schwarzenegger. He wanted to sue. His agent told him no. His manager told him no. His wife told him no, you'll never work again. He said, I'm going to sue them anyway. And he sued them.
And he made a sign that says, I beat him.
The sign said, I beat the bastards.
Right, right up on Hollywood, right?
You're absolutely
billboard.
Right. And never worked more in his life because Hollywood only loves winners. Anyway, when he reviewed me, he called me a fairy, a fruitcake. And how did Westinghouse ever find this fairy, this fruit, to fill in for him? But it was brilliantly written. I mean, it was hurtful, but it was brilliantly written. So when I got the show, I told my producer, Bill Walker, I said, you know, television is the electronic umbilical cord that binds America together and nourishes the world. It'll either save the world or destroy the world because it has information to impart or information to suppress and alter, however it's going to be used. I didn't know it would be used this badly. At the time, it was being used better. And one of the better spokespeople was Harlan Ellison. And I said, I want to book Harlan on the show. He said, God, don't be stupid. The guy hates you. I said, I don't care. I'm going to give him a call. So I got his number was in the phone book. I dialed once and this rough voice answered, yeah. And I said, Harlan? He said, yeah. Who's this? I said, John Barber. He said, oh, shit. And I said, well, you already called me that once. So he started to laugh. And I said, can you talk as well as you write? He said, what a stupid question. Of course I can. I said, well, I have a show that I'm doing on Channel 11 because I didn't get the Merv Griffin show. And I would like you to be my first guest to talk about television. He said, I'm not going to change my mind about my opinion of you. I said, I didn't ask you that. I want you to talk about television. So we book him. The whole town knows how brilliant he is, how much he hates me. And the show's a hit. I mean, everybody watches the first show. So Monday, I get a call from Chuck Young, and he's really laughing. And he says, John, congratulations. The numbers are great. And I just finished talking with Harlan. I said, where? He said, right here in my office. He just left. And I said, oh, great, Chuck. Are you going to give him a show? And he said, no. And I said, why not? The guy's brilliant. He said, John, he wants your show. So I started laughing. Now, here's what happens. My show only lasts 13 weeks. I got 6 more talk shows after that, JG. And the first person I always booked was Harlan Ellison.
Well, you've had a ton of amazing guests on your talk shows over the year through your talk show career. I mean, everyone from Muhammad Ali to LA's most famous gangster, Mickey Cohen. It's a wild story.
Oh my God, what a great, my God, you're just wonderful. First of all, thanks so much for being so well informed, but thank you again for reading the book. I'm deeply impressed, you know, because it's like 740 pages or something.
Well, you know, there was just, if you have maybe a little bit more time, I just wanted to ask you about one more thing.
Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to ask you about, we were talking about your comedy album. Right. It's Tough Being White. And we sort of went over how people like Red Fox and Dick Gregory understood that it wasn't an anti-civil rights thing. It seems like a lot of white people were so horribly offended by it. And yet, you actually were able to take it to a predominantly black audience. You were able to do a set of it to a predominantly black audience in Watts. I would really love to hear that story.
Oh, bless your heart. Well, this came about. I did the album, and even though the LA Times said it was the worst taste album ever, that was their review, I sent the critic a note, and I said, you're supposed to listen to it, not eat it. But in any event, I was booked into the 3 of the Playboy clubs, Atlanta, Miami, and Los Angeles. And so in Atlanta and Miami, I did the material, and it got terrific response. I mean, it's edgy, and there was mixed audience. And when it's mixed and you're touching about on subjects like this, it got a terrific response. But what happens before I get to the L.A., the riots hit in Watts. And so I get to L.A., and Lee Wolfberg, who was the booker, the guy who booked me, says to me, you're not doing any of that black. He didn't call it black. He called it the N-word. You're not doing any of that black stuff in the show. He said it was just horrifying. So you better do something else. And I know you have enough other material. So I agreed that I wouldn't do that. Now, I am introduced. Now, I'm prepared to do an act that's not from the album. And I'm introduced by this black who's now the new room manager. And George is the guy's name, and gives me a very nice introduction. And we have about 25% black in the audience. And there's this huge window that overlooks the city. And you can still see smoke, for God's sake. So anyway, I said, just as a throwaway before I got into the act that I had changed, I said, you know, thanks, George, for that wonderful introduction. But I should tell you that 2 weeks ago, George was just a waiter here. But after the riots, they don't trust him around the knives and forks. Well, the audience howled, especially the blacks. They were screaming. And even this guy, George, he stands up and he applauds. And then I look out the window and I see the smoke, and I said, you can tell it doesn't take much power to light up the city of Los Angeles. It only takes 1 watt, which is a corny joke. But they screamed again, and they responded so well, I figured, well, screw this, I'm going to do the act. So I do the Tough to Be White stuff. I got more applause without a standing ovation than I'd ever had. But when I get off the stage, there is Lee Wolfberg holding a magna, a gun, the magnum, whatever they call it, the damn thing that Clint Eastwood uses, and he drags me to the office. He's calling me all kinds of foul names and how stupid I am, telling me he was ready to shoot them, and that if I wanted to finish, I had better change my act because I was never going to do that again. So I said, but you heard how they reacted. He said, I don't care how they reacted. It's how I react, and I don't want to hear that shit on my stage. And I said, but what if I can prove to you that the black audiences love it? He said, I don't care what you do. I said, well, what if I go to Watts and do it and prove it to you? Now, I didn't mean to say that, but I said it. He said, you better finish this stuff. So in any event, I call Ebony Magazine, and their offices are on Wilshire Boulevard, and I take my album, I go down, and there are 4 or 5 guys there, including the editor. I hand them the album. I asked them to play the first few minutes of the album, which they love, which they absolutely love. And I tell them the problem I'm having with Lee Wolfberg, and I want to prove that blacks are more receptive than to the material than the white. So he said, I said, could you set me up at a club in Watts or Compton, preferably on a Saturday night when there are people there? And so they did. And the story is in the book. My wife and I are the only 2 white people that go down there. And the manager of the club is so impressed and so sort of frightened and nervous about this whole thing that he decides that the MC is not qualified to introduce me, that he will introduce me himself, trying to set the audience up for me. Now, it's a talent night at the club, and like the Apollo Theater, if you are not good in front of a black audience, you know it immediately. Well, the guy that preceded me, his name was Buzzy, and he was a poor man's Jerry Lewis, and he was absolutely god-awful, dreadful. He did jokes about blacks with thick lips, and I mean, it was and kinky hair. I mean, it was just, it was despicable, and it was coming from a black, okay? Anyway, owner gets up and he talks about the fact that I've been on Merv Griffin show, and I'm going to be very successful, and that I've done this. Red Fox is my best friend. I've done this album, having problems with the Playboy management, and that Dick Gregory is my biggest fan, done the liner notes. So already they're ready to like me. I'm introduced and I don't know what to say, because the guy in front of me was just so dreadful. And, of course, the audience is going to talk. They are the noisiest audiences in the world. And finally, one guy hollers out at me, hey, man, Buzzy is sure hard to follow, ain't he? Well, the audience howls. And as softly as I can, I said, yes, sir, that's what I hear the police say, too. Well, they screamed. They screamed and screamed and screamed. So then I started to go into my act, and I said to them, listen, I think you're going to like me, but I don't want you to like me just because I'm white. Well, I almost fell on the floor, and J.G. went, and now the photographer from Ebony is going around taking all these pictures, and my 15-minute set turns into be about 40 minutes, the only standing ovation I ever get. I get hugs all over the place. I'm invited to come back every Saturday. I said, no, that's it for me. So my wife and I go back home to wait. Dick Gregory was made by accident. He was filling in for $50 a night at the Playboy Club in Chicago. A guy from Time Magazine happened to be present. He wrote a very short paragraph about Dick Gregory. And Dick Gregory, as a result of that short paragraph, became a star. And here I was, J.G., envisioning I'm going to have Ebony Magazine with all these pictures telling a 3 or 4 page story of It's Tough to Be White by John Barber. And I'll become as famous as Dick Gregory, and it'll be my passport. I'll become like Lenny Bruce with his dark comedy and Mort Saul with his political comedy, and I'm doing ethnic comedy. And I wait, and I wait for 2 weeks, and nothing happens. So I finally call the editor, and I ask what's going on. He apologized. He said, John, I was going to call you. He said, we just love what you did. Every one of us just absolutely, totally love it. I have all the pictures that we took that I'd be happy to send you. We'd started to write the article, but the owner of the magazine said we can't publish it. And we fought with him and asked him why. He said, do you realize if he gets out there and he starts to talk about race and stuff to be white, it only encourages more ethnic and anti-ethnic dialogue. So no, we're not going to promote it or him. And that was the end of it.
Well, out of curiosity, what was it that you think appealed to, black audiences, Dick Gregory, Red Fox, who we mentioned? Why do you think your humor appealed to them if other people were thinking that it was too... people were trying to paint it as being against the black community when obviously they were fans of it.
Oh, no, it wasn't. You misinterpret that. Blacks, I can't tell some of the very, very simple jokes. Everybody was called, they want to be called X. They were Muslims, right? And I said, what they developed, they've even developed names for all of their famous people, like Jesse Jackson talks so much they call him Windex. Now, it's a corny joke, but it's funny. And Dr. King is called Kleenex. Well, it's funny. Now, what it is, and I said, you know, that if a white man signs an X when he's voting, he's illiterate. When a black man does it, he's an educated Muslim. Well, they loved it, but the people that got nervous were the white people.
That's what I'm saying. The black audiences seemed to understand what you were actually getting at.
Oh, my God. They just absolutely loved it because it was true. The best humor in the world is that which reflects truth. That's why Mark Twain is by far the greatest humorist who ever lived, because everything reeks of the truth, even the simplicity of what he said. I mean, I know 100 things that he said, but things as simple as human beings are the only creatures that blush or have a reason to. I mean, it's beyond genius. He said if voting made a difference, they wouldn't let us do it. I mean, how right is that? And when he said at one point, and this is especially true if you think of the assassinations and the fake wars, he said, it's easier to convince people, it's easier to cheat people than to convince people they have been cheated, which is so true because we've been cheated of the truth for so long. But the blacks just got the truth of it. Whereas it made white people really nervous that I was bringing this up. And that's why Lee Wolper got so upset. He was white and Jewish and really nervous.
Well, yeah, because it sounds like you were making fun of, the white man's prejudices.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, it's very uncomfortable to speak the truth that makes people uncomfortable. It didn't make blacks uncomfortable. It made them laugh because it was true. But it didn't go, in some cases, it didn't go far enough with the whites. I mean, I had a lot of, Bob Crane loved it and Joe Pine loved it. As a matter of fact, when I sat down with Joe Pine, he had a 20-foot long table and he sat me at the far end of the table to interview me. And when he left, he shook my hand. He said, John, I'm sorry I had to put you so far away, but I don't like to sit close to people I like and admire. Isn't that interesting?
Well, that's one of the only times, Joe Pine was probably nice to someone on TV.
You're absolutely right. It was one of the few times he did that. And 20-some-odd years later, when I got his producer was Hal Peretz, who was the one that first told Joe to put me on the air. And Hal turned 50 years of age and could not get a job in Hollywood. He called me at Real People and told me, God, Jesus, they have senior discrimination. I'm only 50, for God's sake. And he said, I still got a lot to do. Can you hire me? So I hired him. And he was one of our best research and great stories about Hal are in the book, too, by the way, which you probably read. But in any event, that was it. But, you know, the one thing that I admire about the book, I have a fan, a girl, you might have read about her in the book, 16 years of age, used to drive her bicycle to Burbank just to come in and listen to my film reviews, became an executive at CBS, retired 8 years ago in Hawaii very successfully. She said she loved my reviews. She loved Real People, loved the documentaries. She said, but the best thing you've ever done is the book. And the reason I like the book so much is the reason that you bring up, regardless of all the awful things that happened, not once did I ever in my life feel sorry for myself. Not once.
Well, I think the other thing, too, is you never really... There's a warmth to the book that I don't see in a lot of people today. I think you actually legitimately like people, and you want to see justice done when wrong is done to we the people. And you don't see that much today. You have a lot of elitism in our society and a lot of hatefulness and bigotry, and your book has none of that. You're saying that we can do better as a people.
Well, I really thank you for that. I mean, these are things that I did not intend to say or meant to say. I'm just cataloging my life's experience. And the other thing I like about the book, there are no chapters. It's written like a series of newspaper columns. So if you like Lenny Bruce, you can turn to five pages on remembering Lenny Bruce. Or if you loved Lucille Ball or George Burns, there's a great story in there about a late evening with George Burns. And he tells how Lucille Ball accidentally becomes the most successful female in show business. They're all great stories you can read just before you go to bed. But if you want to read a great human story, or if people have said no to you 1,000 times and you keep going, this is a book you must read, because I heard no more than 1,000 times. And twice I heard it legally when they put me on a train and a plane and in chains and said, get out of our country.
Well, I was going to say there's a ton of other great stories in the book that we couldn't go over. I mean, Rodney Dangerfield makes an appearance, Jack Nicholson, Karate Kids, Pat Morita, everyone's in this one.
Oh, well, you know what? I'm off to Canada the first week in September, but maybe in October, JG, if you're up to it, I'll come back. You make a list of some of those stories that you'd like to hear, and we'll just tell stories for an hour.
That sounds great to me, John. Hey, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. If you could just plug the book again and how my listeners can get a hold of it.
It's called Your Mother's Not a Virgin, The Bumpy Life and Times of the Canadian Dropout to Change the Face of American Television. If you go to Amazon and get it, the nice thing about that is if you like it or loathe it, you can write a review. All the reviews on Amazon so far are 5-star. But more importantly, go to my site, www.johnbarbersworld.com. You can see the first Garrison tapes for nothing. You can see my appearance on The Tonight Show with Frank Sinatra when I was working with Mr. Sinatra. And then you can find the link to the book, Your Mother's Not a Virgin, and you can buy it off of that link. So thank you again, JG, very much. I just love being with you again.
As do I. And next time we'll have to talk about your little cameo in a really wild TV movie, Pray for the Wildcats. It's one of my favorites.
Oh, my God. How do you remember that stuff?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I collected those little VHS movies back when I was a kid.
I'll tell you one short, two or three sentence story about that. Kirk, the guy who played Captain Kirk. Oh, Jesus.
William Shatner.
Yeah, William Shatner. My son was a Trekkie, a William Shatner junkie. He has the album where Shatner sings, autographed to him. He's met Shatner a couple of times. Anyway, I'm in this movie, Pray for the Wildcats, And I have a really nice looking jacket on, and I play Shatner's boss. And I got to smoke a cigar, and I'm wearing this jacket. So in any event, he loves a jacket. And he said, can I wear that jacket instead of you? So I give him my jacket, but it's my job as his boss to fire him. So I fire him, okay? And I get home after my son sees the movie. I'm out somewhere reviewing or at a dinner or something. I get home, and the first thing my son rushes to me, Dad, how could you fire Captain Kirk? So there you go. We will tell stories in October, JG.
Well, thank you again, John, for coming on Parallax Views. It's been great.
Thank you again. Bye-bye now.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with the always entertaining John Barbour. Be sure to check out his hefty autobiography, Your Mother's Not a Virgin, The Bumpy Life and Times of the Canadian Dropout Who Changed the Face of American TV. Available now from Trinday. Also, you can check out more of John's work, some of his background, at his website, John Barbour's World. That's JohnBarboursWorld.com. A reminder to my listeners that if you enjoyed this and other editions of Parallax Views, your support would greatly be appreciated on Patreon. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.